And John writes, as Jesus speaks, "I tell you the truth, the man who does not enter the sheep pen by the gate, but climbs in by some other way, is a thief and a robber. The man who enters by the gate is the shepherd of his sheep. The watchman opens the gate for him, and the sheep listen to his voice. He calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. When he has brought out all his own, he goes on ahead of them, and his sheep follow him, because they know his voice. But they will never follow a stranger. In fact, they will run away from him, because they do not recognize a stranger's voice." Jesus used this figure of speech, but they didn't understand what he was telling them. Therefore, Jesus said again, "I tell you the truth, I am the gate for the sheep. All who ever came before me were thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not listen to them. I am the gate. Whoever enters through me will be saved. He will come in and go out and find pasture. The thief only comes to steal and kill and destroy. I have come that they might have life and have it to the full. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. The hired hand is not the shepherd who owns the sheep, so when he sees the wolf coming, he abandons the sheep and runs away. Then the wolf attacks the flock and scatters it. The man runs away because he's a hired hand and cares nothing for his sheep. I am the good shepherd. I know my sheep, and my sheep know me, just as the Father knows me, and I know the Father, and I lay down my life for the sheep. I have other sheep that are not of this sheep pen. I must bring them in also. They too will listen to my voice, and there shall be one flock and one shepherd. The reason my Father loves me is that I lay down my life, only to take it up again. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down of my own accord. I have authority to lay it down and authority to take it up again. This command I received from my Father."
It's a remarkable thing we've just heard from John's Gospel there. "I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep." Well, our musicians are going to help us to understand more of what that laying down of the life means by singing to us, and we're going to remain seated as we listen to them. But if you'd like to follow the words, they're printed on the back of the notice sheet.
Well, please do sit down, and as you do so, take hold of a Bible and turn back to that passage we had read, John chapter 10. It's page 1076. While I try and find a way of making myself heard with this voice, let me tell you about some eccentric clergymen. There are many to tell you about, but there was one in particular who declared he'd found the secret of long life. He said it lay in the pinch of gunpowder that he sprinkled on his cornflakes every morning for breakfast. He finally died in his 90s, and he left behind a wife, two children, and an enormous hole where the crematorium used to be. We'll spend no more time on him. But we are going to focus tonight on another claim to life, a remarkable claim that comes in verse 10 of John chapter 10. It's the Lord Jesus speaking, and he says this: "The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I have come that they may have life and have it to the full." Jesus is facing the reality of different siren voices clamoring for our attention. And he wants to say, look where they're leading you. And as he speaks here, he gives a warning to us and a promise. And we're going to look at them both. Firstly, his warning: beware the destroyer. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. Beware, look out for the destroyer. Jesus speaks of a thief all the way through this chapter. He's got particular people in mind. The Pharisees, the religious leaders of his day, claim to see. But Jesus says they were blind. They couldn't even spot God's appointed shepherd when he appeared before them. They refused to recognize Jesus as God's sent one. The shepherd, the leader, the protector, the rescuer king of God's people. For that's what the word would have conjured up. Jesus lived at a time when, in the very recent history, false messiahs had come and several had gathered bands of Jews, captivated by a mix of religious and nationalistic fervor. And they'd led them literally to a bloody end at the hands of Roman occupying forces. The thief comes, says Jesus, only to steal and kill and destroy. Beware the destroyer. We need to be very careful who we listen to. And in the 20th century, we have our false messiahs. We've seen the same terrible tragedies. Some of you will remember back to the Jonestown massacre. All of us will know of the awful events in Waco, Texas last year. Other groupings haven't led to death in the same way, but people like the Children of God, the Moonies, under a great religious zeal, have brought desperate harm to those caught up in their tangled webs. But it doesn't have to center on individuals or groups of people. Philosophies and ideologies insist on another way than Jesus's, another life than Jesus's, and his warning might as equally well be given to them. For of course, no one advertises themselves like this. No one says, listen to me, I've come just to steal and kill and destroy. Oh, no, this isn't the sales pitch. This is just the result, says Jesus. So Chuck Colson, the American Christian, in his latest book, which according to the blurb will reveal the truth behind the headlines, at least in the States, which looks at where things like relativism and humanism and secularism are leading people in the States, he calls it a dance with deception. It's Satan's great ploy in the name of life to give me death. It's very sobering reading. When they can get hold of some, get one. I had to whip the one from the rector. I borrowed the one from the rector's study, and I will return it in the morning, sir. And there is many an ism today that is heading in this direction, isn't there? We still have our optimistic humanism that actually creates a great myth by denying evil. The world wars seem to have blown it apart, but it's resurfacing again under the guise of the New Age. And it'll be a tragedy for our world if we don't believe people can be evil enough to repeat what we've seen in our recent history, in Germany, in Russia. We've got a utopianism that can dismiss evil, that feels the right government will actually manage our lives so that we do have life and we can get rid of evil. You know, we of all people ought not to be fooled by that. It's the most terrible statistic, but in the 20th century, more people have been killed by their own governments than by all the terrible wars put together. We've got a relativism, of course, that's rampant, that denies the distinction between good and evil. I got this letter from a missionary who'd come back to Africa about 17 years ago, this week. When we got back, one of the first gadgets he wrote we invested in was a vacuum cleaner. It's nearly at the end of its life now, so we'll soon be buying a new one. In the intervening 17 years, our house has been kept clean by a vacuum. It sucks the dirt. We're on the outside being kept clean, and inside the cleaner is a rather revolting bag accumulating dirt. What we have in Britain, he went on just now, is a vacuum, a moral vacuum, and it is efficiently sucking in the dirt. Unfortunately, we're inside the bag, on the receiving end of the dirt, instead of on the outside being kept free of it. The Prime Minister's instinct that we need to get back to basics is surely right. The problem is that for some reason, the obvious fact that a clean society is more or less equal to the sum of a lot of clean individuals is being denied. Public morality is simply the summing up of private morality. A pile of dirt is the sum of lots of little bits of dirt. I don't know if his analysis is right in every detail, but it's fairly irrefutable at other levels, isn't it? In the broad sweep. Now we've got individualism, which when it's linked to consumerism, drives us to excess and isolation. So the psychologists delight to tell the story of the girl who's exhausted from all her partying and seeking pleasure and says with incredulity in the middle of a session, "Oh, so you mean I don't have to do what I want to do?" We've found materialism doesn't pay. If you've ever read Paul Getty's biography, it should be warning enough. He's one of the richest men in the world, or rather he was, but his family was never free from feuding. His sons never felt he loved them or that he had time for them. And someone described his life story as being of a wealth that afforded him no joy through 5 marriages, 5 divorces, 2 miserable deaths, and unforgiving, unrelenting miserliness. A legend of luxury, lust, and loneliness. But we won't all be Paul Getty. But we can see it at a more mundane level. Just before those in their 20s and their 30s and their 40s, we catch the glint of excitement in the eyes and the anticipation that they'll see it all and do it all and get it all. Do look at the older generations. I've seen it in my father's generations, just the fear, just the doubt that lurks there in their 50s and 60s and 70s, that they have seen it all and they have done it all and they've still missed it all. Beware the destroyer. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. And of course, ultimately, the whoever, the whatever it is that we're listening to, what do they have to offer when we get to the great day, when we're face to face with the living God? On the day when we line up for judgment, what will our leader, what will our philosophy have to offer us then? I was coming in tonight and passed, as I always do when I go down the Mile End Road, the statue to William Booth, the great Salvation Army general, who did a remarkable work down the East End. One of the stories about him that always sticks in my mind is of his son sleeping in the same room as him one night and hearing his father tossing and turning and saying rather concernedly, "Shouldn't you be asleep, Dad?" And he says, "No, I'm thinking. I'm thinking about the people's sins. What will they do with their sins?" Too late then to discover that the thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. Beware the destroyer. But the verse goes on. "I have come that they may have life and have it to the full. Beware the destroyer. Listen to the life giver." Jesus is far from the self-effacing teacher that so many imagine. Already in this gospel, he's declared, "I am the bread of life, the staple diet. Can't get life without me. I am the light of the world." It's him saying it, not me. Here he says, "I am the good shepherd. I am the gate that opens to life. The one God's given to lead his people to life in all its fullness. We can understand the picture, can't we? It's the shepherd's job to lead the sheep to where there's green pasture. So he says, I've come that they may have life and have it to the full. And the PR firms, of course, reverse this verse. They want to tell us that Christianity will only steal and kill and destroy and spoil lives. No, it's everything else that'll give you life. And life to the full. But Jesus says, now I've come that they may have life and have it to the full. A young Japanese convert was asked by her friend once, don't you find Christianity leaves you all fenced in? Yes, she said. I must admit, I do find the fences are going up. But I find that inside the fence, it's like a garden. And outside, it's like a desert. And when I start out to walk from one side of the garden to the other, I find I never get to the other side. I think many a Christian would know what she's talking about. Let me put it in more basic terms, because I was talking to a city businessman. He was telling me something of his life story about how his life had focused around drink, success, women. Rather tellingly, he added to me, they never quite delivered. But about 4 or 5 years ago, he was converted. And he laughed at the thought that he'd be sitting, talking as he was with me, and saying he'd found life in Christ. I know. Don't get me wrong, it wasn't as if everything was plain sailing. There was many a battle. There are many imperfections in him. He's married now with children, and they'll show you your imperfections quicker than anything. There was many a setback and a difficulty he was facing, but he'd found life, and he was infectiously full of it. I have come that they may have life. Gauguin, the famous painter, in his last days made a great journey from Brittany to Tahiti and landed up in Boston in America. And there he painted his last great painting. It was an enormous frieze. And in the top left-hand corner, he just wrote in French 3 questions. I'll translate them for you. It'll help you and help me. Where have we come from? Who are we? Where are we going? Shortly after he finished the painting, he attempted suicide. Nigel Gosling, writing in The Observer, said this, the treasure he found at the end of that great rainbow which stretched from Pont-Aven to Tahiti was not just a bundle of girly charms. It was heavy and rather unpleasant, and in the end, it killed. In this, his last supreme achievement, the great frieze he executed as his final testament before his bungled suicide, there's no panorama of terrestrial paradise. It's full of doubt. And in the title he gave it, he asked the ultimate questions and did not stay for an answer. There isn't one. But Jesus insists there is. I wish I could say that I'd thought of the questions before I turned to Christ. He had to teach me the questions in order to show me he'd got the answers. But it's as a Christian we'll discover significance and worth. A life in context again with the God who made me, so that's where I came from. A God who has a purpose for me? I cannot have a greater value, can I, than that God should choose me? It's no good looking for value and significance in my life. It'll never suffice for me. But that God, the Good Shepherd, should come and lay down his life for me. How can there be a greater worth than that? Who am I? His person. The one he adopted. It's not that when those truths are in place, There are no problems. It's just that everything else is put in perspective. I've come that they may have life and have it to the full. Yes, even when you want to stretch it to the ultimate crunch points, to the life beyond death points. Now, people always ask the question. Colin Morris, when he was doing a television program called Start Your Own Religion, said this: DIY begins with an expression of need, and so does religion. One of those needs is to come to terms with mortality, because of all creatures on earth, we alone know that we must die. Well, Gerald Scarfe, the cartoonist, described in another program something of the difficulties we all have of facing up to this moment and what possibilities are beyond. He depicted a surrealist flight through optimistic options based on an airport lounge. Air Buddha, for example, offered 2 for the price of 1. We bring you straight back. Agnostic airlines weren't sure if they had an airplane at all. Church of England flights were, of course, fog-bound. And someone, I think very tellingly, has said this: what man really fears is not so much extinction, but extinction with insignificance. That's why things like headstones are so important to us, isn't it? Why obituaries matter. Jesus goes far further than headstones and obituaries. There's nothing fog-bound about his plans. He declares, "I am the resurrection and the life." And he doesn't make the claim in a lecture room in some ivory tower. No, he declares it in a funeral parlor. In a bereaved person's home, where a brother has been dead and buried for 4 days, a friend of Jesus. It's an astonishing story. You'll see it start just across the page, the next chapter. He's told that the man Lazarus is ill. Yet according to verse 6 of chapter 11, when he heard that Lazarus was sick, he stayed where he was 2 more days. Well, he must have something remarkable in store. I turn over the page, and I discover at the top of the next page, verse 14, he tells his disciples plainly, "Lazarus is dead, and for your sake I'm glad I wasn't there, so that you may believe." He's putting Mary and Martha, the sisters, and Lazarus through all of this for his disciples' sake, for our sake, so that we may believe. He journeys there to Bethany. He comes to the sisters' home, and he says to them in verse 25, "I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live even though he dies." You go and speak to someone who's mourning the death of a loved one and speak like that, and you better be able to deliver. Can you think of anything more cruel? And if I couldn't, they move to the graveside. They come to the tomb, and in the shortest verse in the Bible, verse 35, we're told Jesus wept. Almighty God, who made the whole universe, who will judge every one of us, has been into the world, has stood by the graveside of someone he loved and wept. And then the Jews said, "See how he loved him." But some of them said, "Couldn't he who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man from dying?" Well, of course he could, but then we'd have never known if he was the resurrection and the life. So he comes to the tomb. It's a cave with a stone laid across the entrance. And in verse 39, he says, "Take away the stone." And Martha, the sister of the dead man, says, "But Lord, by this time there's a bad odor. He's been there for 4 days. See, the New Testament manages to keep its head right, its feet very firmly on the ground, doesn't it? Even at the most remarkable moments, the old versions say, "But Lord, behold, he stinketh." Doesn't matter how you translate it, it's very clear what's happening, isn't it? This man is dead. Verse 43, when he'd said this, Jesus called in a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out!" And the dead man came out, hands and feet wrapped with strips of linen, a cloth around his feet, face, and Jesus said to them, take off the grave clothes and let him go. It is impressive evidence, my friends. Jesus calls Lazarus up from the dead, 4 days gone, so that I can believe he is the resurrection and the life. Trust me, says Jesus, I can handle death. He who believes in me will live, even though he dies. I'm in charge of what happens after death, says Jesus, and what happens depends on your attitude to me. We keep talking in ifs and buts. We seem to delight in a vagueness about the future. And Jesus says, I'll tell you the outcome of Judgment Day. Just think you can go to your death knowing it. Yes, he means it when he says, back in our verse in chapter 10, I have come that they may have life and have it to the full. But we're slow to trust, of course. Saatchi and Saatchi, or whatever their equivalents are, have done a good job. So he gives us one more reason why we should believe him. Look at verse 11. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. The hard hand isn't the shepherd who owns the sheep. So when he sees the wolf coming, he abandons the sheep and runs away. And then the wolf attacks the flock and scatters it. The man runs away because he's a hard hand and cares nothing for the sheep. But I am the good shepherd, and I lay down my life for the sheep. See, when the crunch comes, who'll be for us? When we've offended, when we've got to face the consequences, when we've got to face the ultimate wolf, death and judgment, what will I do with my sins? Leave them to the shepherd, who went to the cross to face the judgment on them in my place. Chuck Colson's been working in prison cells ever since he got sent there himself. He tells a remarkable story of one prison in Brazil. It was handed over about 20 years ago to two Christian laymen. There are now two full-time staff, and the rest of the work is done by inmates. He said when he visited there, he found it remarkable. The inmates were smiling, particularly the murderer who held the keys and let him in. It's not just sort of wishy-washy thinking. He says that it has an astonishing record. Its recidivism rate is 4%. Only 4% of the inmates, when they're released, return to crime. That compares to 75% in the rest of Brazil and the United States. He says, how's all this possible? I saw the answer when my guide escorted me to the notorious punishment cell, once used for torture. Today, he told me, that block houses only a single inmate. And as we reached the end of a long concrete corridor, he put the key into the lock. He paused and asked, are you sure you want to go in? Oh, of course, I replied. I've been in isolation cells all over the world. Get on with it. So slowly, he swung open the massive door, and I saw the prisoner in that punishment cell. A crucifix, beautifully carved by the inmates, the prisoner Jesus, hanging on the cross. He's doing time for all the rest of us, the guide said slowly. I'm the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. I've come that they may have life and have it to the full. Beware the destroyer. Listen to the life giver. You may have seen in the papers this week that they're worried that bungee jumping might damage the brain. They've been testing some brains after bungee jumps. I'd have thought you need to test them before bungee jumps, but it's neither here nor there. It reminded me of a bit I was reading in John Cleese's latest book about life and how you survive it, where he was told of a test done on people who'd attempted suicide jumping off at the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco and failing. Every person reported during and after their jumps feelings of spiritual rebirth and unity with others, the universe and God. And as a result, many of them underwent quite dramatic conversions, though we're not told quite what to. So John Cleese comes up with this typical Cleese-like suggestion. Perhaps the Church of England would do better if they incorporated some kind of bungee jumping into morning service. Well, of course, that's just trivial and for fun, but there are people who seem to think that the whole business of Christianity is all about something as sort of remarkable and odd and way out and being zapped as maybe what happens when you go bungee jumping. And as we look here, we realize that the question is far simpler than that, isn't it? It's not, have you had a remarkable jump recently? It's, who are you listening to? That's the question we've got to face tonight. Who are you listening to? Well, no one's listening to Radio 1. We know that at the moment. So who are we tuned into? The destroyer or the life giver? See, the mark of the Christian is not that they've gone bungee jumping, not that they've had dramatic experiences. They may not. No, the one thing you can know for sure about the genuine Christian is they're listening to Jesus. You see, we listen to so many people. It's really rather a trivial matter, isn't it? No, it is the big issue. The thief has come only to steal and kill and destroy. I've come that they may have life and life to the full. Now, who are you listening to? Because to listen is to follow. And whom I follow determines where I land up. Be a marvelous night to sort out whom I'm going to listen to, isn't it? And where I'm going to be heading? To actually start listening to Jesus. To move from heading to destruction to heading to life. I can't end a week like this without inviting people to make that step. To tune their radios differently. I'm going to pray a prayer in just a few moments. It's a prayer really of retuning our lives. I'll run it past you first and see if it's for you. I do it because I've found over the years that if we're not used to listening to Jesus, we're very often not used to speaking to him. And people say, what do I say? How do I actually put it? Well, I can't put it the way you'd want to put it, but let's see if this is near enough. And I'll run it past you first because not everyone tonight will be at the stage where they're ready to retune their radios. And we don't want any of this arm-twisting nonsense. So if it's not you, well, don't pray it. Here's what I think's involved in retuning our radios. Here's what I'd be praying, something along these lines. Lord, I have not listened to you as I ought. Thank you for giving Jesus to die for my sins. Help me to follow him as my Lord and life giver. That for you? Because if it is, when I pray in just a few seconds time, I'll pray it sentence by sentence. I'll leave a gap in between. Just echo it in your hearts. If you can improve on it, well, improve on it in the gap. That's fine. If it's not you, I'll ask you just to respect the silence, to think your thoughts. Pray your prayers. Who am I listening to? The destroyer or the life giver? The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I've come that they may have life and have it to the full. Now let's be quiet and then I'll pray. Here's that simple prayer. Lord, I have not listened to you as I ought. Thank you for giving Jesus to die for my sins. Help me to follow him as my Lord and life giver. Amen. Let me just say a couple more practical things as I finish. Some will no doubt be confused still. There are too many stations on the set to sort everything out in one night. May I just repeat what Justin said? These Discovering Christianity groups are a great place to sort that out. Lots of people have done it in the past. Lots are coming to start this week. Just at the end of the service, simply fill in your name and where we can get hold of you. Tick the night that suits you best. Rip it off, which isn't a very strenuous exercise, and put it in one of the bins by that door on the way out. For others, this has been a night to set things right. Let me say, these groups are great as well. There's much sorting out we all have to do. And do similarly fill it in at the end of the service. I've also got a little booklet here called On Your Marks. Comes in two parts. The first part very briefly explains starting the Christian life and what it's all about. And the second part is simply a copy of Mark's Gospel. As we read it, we'll start listening to Jesus. I'd love to give you a copy. I'll be by a table by that door there. And if you're willing to read it, I'd love you to take one. Thank you for listening so patiently.